You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM.
Neil McLean calls it the shock doctrine, the use of the uncertainty and chaos created by disasters and crises to push through extreme policies and agendas that would be difficult to do under other circumstances. A recent article originally published in the online magazine The Bullet argues that the Canadian government is using the current global economic crisis and the calls for stimulus spending to expand its colonial agenda, particularly in the areas of Indigenous rights and environmental regulation. Todd Gordon is author of that article. He's an assistant professor of Canadian Studies at the University of Toronto, and he joins me on the phone now. Good morning, Todd, and welcome to Vancouver Cooperative Radio.
Good morning, and thank you for having me.
So how is the Conservative government dealing with the economic crisis to pursue this shock doctrine agenda?
Well, as people know, there's been a push across Canadian society for the government to increase its spending, its stimulus spending, as a way of ameliorating the crisis and its impacts on people. And the Tories, with the pretty much uncritical support of the Ignatieff-led Liberals, have been using this as an opportunity to push through a revamping of environmental assessment policies that are by law mandated to in cases where federal spending is done for public projects, as well as to fund projects, infrastructure spending projects that will be a boon to exploration for mining, oil and gas, pipeline expansion, and so on, that will largely impact First Nation communities in parts of the country, particularly in British Columbia and Alberta, but elsewhere as well.
You point out in your article what you call relentless capitalism has been kept in check to some degree, you say, by the efforts of First Nations to defend their lands. How would you evaluate the success of those efforts to put some restraints on capitalist development?
Well, I think it's been very important. No doubt capitalism has been based, since it began in Canada, it's been based on the displacement of First Nations and the expropriation of their land and their resources. And we can think of many, many instances in the last 150 to 200 years in which mineral resources or oil and gas or even farmland or highways and so on connecting or railroads connecting various regions of the country have been built by the displacement of Indigenous communities, and whereby Indigenous peoples, when they're displaced, are forced into working on the railroads and the mines and so on. So capitalism is preceded by displacing First Nations. However, it has been an uneven process, even over those last 150 years. And so there are parts of the country where capitalist relations have not been fully developed yet, and where people, particularly Indigenous peoples, have not been completely or totally absorbed into the capitalist economy, and their resources haven't been fully absorbed in the capitalist economy. And that's because First Nations communities have resisted it in various ways, often, as people may be aware, in direct confrontational ways, blockades and so on, but in some cases through court challenges and the like. And environmental groups have also played a role here in challenging the sort of the unchecked growth of capitalism, particularly in the resource industry, given the terrible environmental legacy that mining, oil and gas development, hydro damming, and the like actually have. So if it wasn't for First Nation groups in particular, this country, I think, and its resources would be more fully absorbed into the capitalist marketplace in a way that it hasn't fully yet in particular regions. So I think their resistance has been very, very important, and that's why this is so crucial right now, because the Tory government is clearly using or exploiting exploiting the crisis and the genuine fears it's instilled in people across the country who are losing their jobs or are fearing losing their jobs. It's exploiting this fear to try and push this agenda of displacement and expropriation of Indigenous land and resources much more fully than it's been able to in the past.
Can you give us some more detail on how the Tories are using the rhetoric of the crisis to undermine various regulatory regimes that have been gained?
Well, I'll note first that what they've been doing is they've been talking about it and they've been hinting at what they would like to do. It hasn't been fully put in place yet, these sort of the retrenchment of these kind of regulatory gains that that we've mentioned, but certainly they have been talking publicly, the Tories that is, have been talking publicly about gutting the Environmental Assessment Act. That's a federal government policy, or legislation rather, that mandates the government engage in environmental assessments every time it puts public money into or public spending into a project. And so the Minister of the Environment, Jim Prentice, has been stumping to business audiences about the plans of the government to overhaul the act, and they use the term modernize, quote-unquote. So modernize obviously means to weaken environmental legislation in the eyes of the Tories. And a leaked government document suggested that they plan on cutting environmental reviews through the revamped legislation by as much as 95%, or at least that's a goal of theirs. At the same time, they've also talked about actually just simply fast-tracking infrastructure spending on the premise that in order to stave off the recession and to provide people with job support, they need to get the infrastructure spending flowing as quickly as possible. And so therefore, they are reserving the right to simply ignore the need for environmental assessments in future infrastructure spending projects. And I believe they've talked about giving themselves 2 years in order to simply avoid assessment projects or assessments on projects that they'll be commencing over the next couple of years. So there's a sort of two-pronged approach here. One is to cut or revamp the Environmental Assessments Act. The other is to simply avoid environmental assessments for the next 2 years on the basis of the urgency of the crisis. At the same time, they talk about, well, we can cut the Environmental Assessments Act at the federal level because there's a provincial assessments. Well, and so all provinces do their own assessments as well. However, as a number of people have pointed out, various provinces, they have different baselines for what is considered good assessments. In British Columbia, the assessments provisions there have been widely criticized by the Indigenous groups as being very weak and clearly biased in favor of business interests. And the Ontario Liberal government of Dalton McGuinty announced in 2008 in a document called Open for Business, Guide to Reduce the Burden, that it plans on cutting regulations in, or as they call red tape, in every ministry by 25%. So what you're seeing is a real cut at both the federal and the provincial level.
What examples might you point to for this argument that the new infrastructure spending is aimed to further a domestic colonial agenda, as you name it?
Well, I think there's a number, excuse me, and not all the infrastructure spending has actually been announced yet, and so that's worth noting. Some of the infrastructure spending was announced a year or so ago under a program that was instigated prior to the financial meltdown, and then they're expediting that money and those projects. But not all the projects that they plan to, as a response to the crisis, have actually been announced. But thus far, there's a few examples that immediately come to mind, and one of them is around the Mackenzie Valley Pipeline, which is the largest infrastructural project in Canadian history, with a cost estimated at about $16 billion and increasing. And there are some Indigenous communities that have come on board in the hopes that the pipeline, which is going to bring natural gas down from the Beaufort Sea through the Mackenzie Valley Delta to the tar sands in Alberta, First Nation communities are apprehensively sympathetic because their hope is that they can get some money out of it without having their communities completely destroyed by environmental degradation that will incur as a result of all the developments that will surround the building of a pipeline. But a number of indigenous communities or some number of indigenous activists are actually still opposed to it. But the federal government has pledged money to get this project underway because it's been planned for a while now, but it's been held up by assessments and some wrangling over money by resource corporations that are involved in the project. And they haven't announced how much they plan on offering the pipeline consortium, but some people suggested it could be as high as $2 billion. So just as an example, there's the Mackenzie Valley Pipeline. That is very controversial. Its controversy goes back decades, because if the pipeline is built, not only will it expand the tar sands, which is, as people know, environmentally problematic and is based largely on stolen indigenous land, but it will spur further gas and mineral exploration along the route of the pipeline, because now companies will think, well, there's a steady supply of energy coming down from the Beaufort Sea, and so it'll be easier to develop projects in the area along the pipeline. So it could have a huge, huge impact for the region, its environment, and indigenous communities there. And so for that reason, the indigenous groups and environmental campaigners have slowed the process down. So it's been taking a while. Now that the federal government has come on board and said we're going to put money into it as a result of or following the financial meltdown, they've also been saying, and Jim Prentice has said this in the press, that he's tired of the holdups and they need to get going on the project. So now the federal government is bringing even greater weight to bear on the project, not only with money, but with pressure to actually get it started. So this will have a huge impact. And this is largely a result of the financial crisis.
And do you think that this throwing more money at it will actually make it more facilitate getting some indigenous cooperation with the projects?
Well, it's definitely a possibility. I think what's going on now, though, I mean, there is, as I've said, there are indigenous communities who are sympathetic to it, apprehensively, though, because I think their feeling is that you know, they've been decimated by centuries of colonialism, and they see the pipeline and the revenues that can be generated from it as a potential way out of poverty. Although, as I said, they are apprehensive insofar as there is a recognition that if it is not done carefully and there isn't proper environmental regulation done, that their communities can be, the land base of their communities could be destroyed. But I think that the money is meant, because there's been wrangling before the financial crisis between the various oil companies, many of them American, around how much it's going to cost, and some of them are demanding money from the federal government in order to get the project going. And so I think that the money that's coming from the federal project that was announced by none other than Environment Minister Jim Prentice two months ago, I think that money is not necessarily meant to bring First Nations on board as much as it is to really just get the project going with the oil companies.
Now, the government, following that line up, the government has promised spending in its budget for First Nations. Is that at all a significant amount or much less?
No, I don't think so. And I think people need to be careful about that. So, for example, I suggested to you that while the federal government has not publicly announced how much it plans on spending on the Mackenzie Valley Pipeline, some estimates that I read, some people have suggested that it probably will be around $2 billion. Well, they promised $1.4 billion to First Nations. So they're not even spending as much on First Nations as they are on the Mackenzie Valley Pipeline. And that doesn't take into account, obviously, the other projects that they're going to be spending on in British Columbia for roadway expansion and so on to help develop oil and gas infrastructure in the province of British Columbia. So the spending that the Tories have promised for First Nations in the last budget pales in comparison to what they're spending on infrastructure projects that will inevitably have an impact on First Nation communities. But it also pales into comparison with what was promised by the Liberal government in the 2005 Kelowna Accord, which is, I believe, approximately $5 billion or so. And even that was criticized by some First Nations activists as simply not enough, given the problems of infrastructure and First Nation communities, the problems of clean water, the problem of lack of adequate housing, lack of adequate health care and infrastructure for schooling and so on. So there's a real problem in First Nation communities with lack of funding that's been going on for a long, long time. And that was not properly addressed by the Liberal government and is nowhere near being addressed by the Tories. So if the Liberal government was doing half measures, as some people suggested, the Tory government is doing even less than that.
Yeah, you argue in your article as well that progressive people, leftists, risk supporting these colonial policies. Could you explain why you think that?
Sure. My point is simply that people, working people and poor people in Canada are quite rightly concerned about the financial crisis and the devastating impact it's going to have on their lives. Loss of jobs, in a context in which employment insurance is nowhere near adequate to support people who lose their jobs, particularly who lose them in the long term, where public housing across the country has taken a hit as a result of 25 years of neoliberalism, and so on. So we simply don't have the kind of welfare state that can protect people in times of need and times when unemployment, as we all know, is rising. And so as a result, people are quite rightly, and people on the left and the organized left and activists and so on are quite rightly demanding the government spend more to ameliorate the impacts of the crisis, to provide people with decent jobs, with opportunities to avoid poverty and so on, and that's a good thing. We should be demanding those things. However, if we simply do it without taking into account the way in which the government is planning its infrastructure spending currently, then we do risk reproducing colonialism. If we simply demand more jobs to build roadways that will make it easier for mineral corporations to exploit resources on First Nation land, then we are reproducing colonialism, internal colonialism. So what we need to be doing is making those demands for jobs and for spending and the like, but we need to be making those demands in such a way that also challenge the government's desire to use those demands and increased spending and fears of the crisis to expedite or intensify colonialism. So we just have to be very clear that we're not supporting colonialism as we're supporting increase in spending.
Well, thank you very much for joining us this morning, Todd.
Thank you for having me.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
I've been speaking with Todd Gordon. He's Assistant Professor of Canadian Studies at the University of Toronto. You can read his original article on this subject. It's posted at socialistproject.ca.